Nasrallah urged Saudi Arabia to immediately end its war on Yemen and lift its blockade on its southern neighbor. Said Nasrallah called on Saudi Arabia not to waste time by proposing deceiving initiatives which lead to nowhere, and stressed that stopping the war and the blockade should be simultaneous. Nasrallah also warned of a Saudi plot to blame Yemen's Ansarullah movement for the ongoing conflict in the war-torn country.
You need to stop the war and end the blockade. Then we can sit and negotiate. Here's where the deception lies. What does it mean if you stop the war without ending the blockade? It means that what they could not realize through a military war, they want to achieve through humanitarian and social pressure.
Elsewhere in his remarks, he said the U.S. is not as strong as before and is on a path toward collapse, while the axis of resistance is gaining power.
America is no longer the America that you knew. There is one main issue that Imam Khamenei has stressed in the last year, and I call on everyone in the region to ponder on that thought. That is the decline of the U.S. America is taking the downward path.
Speaking at an event commemorating late Sheikh Ahmad al-Zin, who was a pioneer in clerics who spoke for Palestine, Nasrallah stressed that the so-called deal of the century has died as a result of the Palestinian people's patience. Observers believe Sayyid Nasrallah's views shows that there is an opportunity for the entire region, even for the Saudis, to be able to stop the crisis of the war they launched on Yemen.
The speech of Sayyid Hassan shows that all regional sides enjoy an opportunity to hold on to their principles and at the same time preserve their achievements. This is true even with the issue of Islamic Republic of Iran and its nuclear program. All of these developments can pave the way for achieving political results.
Hezbollah leader also warned regional countries against relying on the United States. Hezbollah's leader then touched upon the political impasse in Lebanon, calling for the immediate formation of a new government. Hezbollah's Secretary General has stressed in his speech that most of the wars in the region, namely in Syria or Yemen, are mainly aimed to target the resistance and the Palestinian cause and to create a Sunni-Shia rift. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
The prosecution in Sheikh Zazaki's trial finally completed the presentation of witnesses when the trial resumed in a Kaduna High Court, where the Islamic cleric is standing trial for culpable homicide and other charges, which he pleaded not guilty. The prosecution lawyer expressed the hope that he will get a conviction following the presentation of credible witnesses.
We presented about 15 witnesses for the prosecution. 15 top army generals that were key actors, key players in the whole of the saga that led to the filing of the charges against Balaam Sheikh Zaki. One of our prayers is that the court should overrule the no-case submission, overrule the defense, and convict the defendants accordingly and pass the necessary sentence as provided for.
However, Zazaki's defense team dismissed the claim of the prosecution as it affirmed an earlier position that there shouldn't even have been a case against the Islamic cleric.
So far, based on the evidence advanced thus far, all the 15 witnesses so far, in our estimation, has not made any submission or given any evidence that incriminates the defendant in any manner whatsoever. So it's on that basis that we will be entering the no-case submission.
Sheikh Zazaki and his wife Zinat have been in detention for over 5 years despite the ruling of a federal high court ordering for their release. Over 340 of Sheikh Zazaki's supporters were killed, including three of his biological sons, when soldiers of the Nigerian army attacked his home and worship center in December 2015. Sheikh Ibrahim Al-Zazaki and his wife Zinat are detained in the Kaduna Correctional Facility, not far from this courthouse where the trial is taking place. Sheikh Ibrahim Al-Zazaki has just turned 70, and his supporters are calling for his immediate and unconditional release. Danjuma Abdullahi, Kaduna.
The European-wide Islamophobia epidemic has shown little sign of curbing as more countries join the criticized burqa ban. Swiss Muslims have been the latest to feel the effects of hate after a referendum passed banning all face coverings in public spaces.
Être libre, c'est pouvoir montrer son visage.
Being free is to be able to show our face, respect women's dignity, have our own identity, and therefore I do not understand the discourse of people who want to imprison women behind this veil.
Following the ban, I reached out to Zainab, a German national who travels regularly to Switzerland, and asked how the ban has impacted her.
This ban makes me really sad and angry because it's the second article here in the federal constitution against the Islam. I think we have to understand that it's not against the niqab or against the minaret. It's against the global Islam. It's just an Islamophobia act, and I think they are not finished. They are looking for the next step.
The ban isn't the first anti-Islam move adopted by the Swiss, as I found out after speaking to the Islamic Central Council of Switzerland.
I just can confirm you, I mean, Swiss chocolate is great. Even we Muslims, we love it. And Toblerone is now even halal, so it's a great thing, yeah? In terms of Islamophobia, this is less great, yes, indeed. Actually, we are indeed suffering since 2009, when this first referendum came up against the minarets, which has been indeed banned with 57.3% of the Swiss population voting yes for this ban. We are constantly, during the last 10 years as a community, have been attacked by the media, have been the target of certain stereotypes.
Local campaigners and activists have vowed to fight back against the ban. However, the global Muslim attention fixed elsewhere. The defenders of Islam in Switzerland have yet to receive the support they deserve.
The reasons behind enforcing the ban vary from country to country, with some claiming it's a security threat, while others simply say that it contradicts Western ideals. Now, whatever the excuse, the traumatizing effect that the ban has on devout Muslim women has been made clear by those who suffer from its enforcement. Robert Carter, London.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program, The Key, here at IRIB English Radio. I'm your host, Shiraz Agha. Thank you for joining us here today.
We've begun discussing monotheism and the divine attributes in the last few episodes. Shiite scholars believe that God is one, in contrast to other religions such as Christianity.
He's completely immaterial being.
We don't believe that in the Trinity and that there's three dimensions to God, Holy Spirit, Jesus, and God. We don't believe that he's a physical body. Also, in contrast to other sects in Islam, within Islam, Shiism doesn't believe that God is a physical body. We believe that he has absolute power, he has absolute knowledge. Also, the verses of the Holy Quran in which physical attributes have been ascribed to God, such as having a hand, and so on and so forth, we don't take these literally. We interpret them in a different way, in contrast to other sects within Islam. This is very important, and we're going to be repeating this throughout all of our episodes. It's necessary to make this clear. So even if you see such expressions as the hand of God, it's important not to take this literally, because God doesn't have human-like characteristics such as a physical body.
Today we're going to be examining a very important question that people often ask, and that's this. That in these very basic books about Islam, as well as advanced books about Islamic doctrine, we see that in a section on the discussion on God, specifically in the section on the discussion on his attributes and his beautiful names, we see that some of our scholars have divided God's attributes into a couple of categories. There's different divisions for his attributes. One of these divisions is the division of his attributes into his attributes, into attributes which are positive and attributes which are negative. So this sometimes leads to a question in the minds of the person who comes into contact with such a division. Somebody might say that we know that God is absolute perfection, and it's impossible for him to be lacking any perfection. Otherwise, he would be obviously limited and imperfect, and such a being, you know, it's not possible for such a being to be God. It goes against the very definition of God and the concept of what God is. So the question that arises here is this, that what then do these negative attributes mean? What are we exactly negating from God when we say that he is not a physical body, he cannot be seen, he is not in any place, he's not in any, he doesn't have a hand, he doesn't have an eye, you know, he doesn't, he and so on and so forth. This objection could be exasperated and could be reinforced when we take into consideration the fact that in human beings and in other creatures of God, these things are actually perfections. These are perfections for us. It's good for me to be you know, in school, you know, in a certain place. It's a perfection for me. If I wasn't there, you know, I would be imperfect, for example. Or if there was something that actually has a physical body, it's more perfect than a being that doesn't even exist. So this might give rise to a question, and that question is that what exactly are we negating when we negate these qualities and these attributes from God? The answer to this question is that it's true. Then when we predicate these things for God's creatures, they do imply a certain perfection. For example, being in a certain place implies being present there, existing in that place, or it might also necessitate having knowledge of the place where the person is or the things that are surrounding the person in that place. When we negate something from God, we're negating the dimensions of imperfection that stem from that attribute. Like, for example, when we say that a certain thing exists in a certain place, it also, not only does it imply that this thing is present and exists in that place, it also implies that it's not present in another place, which is an imperfection. So the thing that we're negating from God in this, and when we negate this thing, this attribute or this quality from God, is this dimension of imperfection. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. We were looking at the meanings of the negative attributes of God. Until next time, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hussain Aga, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy, on the program The Key on IRIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to English Radio at irib.ir.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The subcontinent. is your host, John, and I welcome you back to another episode of The Subcontinent. Our program aims to address important issues in the subcontinent which affect the governments, people, organizations, and the region of South Asia as a whole. We will try to explain the issues, break down controversies surrounding them, and try to have some external perspectives from experts and people.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we are going to talk about the recent ceasefire agreement between India and Pakistan that has brought back relative peace along the disputed border areas. Then we will explore the reverberations of the New Deal in the domestic and foreign politics of the two countries, as well as its numerous repercussions for the geopolitical future of Asia.
India and Pakistan have recently issued a joint statement to announce that they will strictly observe all of their agreements on ceasefire along the so-called line of control and other disputed areas. This was the first joint statement in nearly 20 years. Historically, whenever ceasefires are announced via different statements, they tend to fail. But a joint statement by both militaries is a proof that the deal is a result of back-channel negotiations and may have a better chance to last. Should it hold, the new agreement may be a big deal for India and Pakistan, and arguably for the whole world.
The recent India-Pakistan ceasefire agreement along the so-called line of control has brought relative calm to border areas, which were the scenes of bloody conflicts for much of the 2020 well into this year. After over a decade of fighting since their last similar deal, the Director Generals of Military Operations of the two nations issued a rare joint statement that put into effect the cessation of hostilities since late February. The generals said from now on they want to address each other's core issues and concerns, and also envisage pullback of specialized forces that are stationed for trans-border offensive maneuvers and operations. Since their great partition, Islamabad and New Delhi have been caught in a vicious circle that has been deadly and devastating, and have come up with numerous agreements with limited longevity. But the New Deal is reported to be the result of many rounds of high-level back-channel negotiations away from the public eye, and probably many politicians. Hence, hopes are a little higher. However, their flimsy communication hotline is still in a nascent stage, and only a test of time will tell if it has the potential to create a lasting peace between the two nuclear-armed countries.
Weeks after India and Pakistan agreed on quote-unquote strict observance of the 2003 ceasefire, the pact continues to be followed on the ground with no apparent signs of violation. With the renewal of their commitment to nearly two-decade-old ceasefire along the border, the winds of change are blowing in relations of the two. But are they strong enough to turn the tide in the deep sea of distrust between the two classic adversaries?
India and Pakistan, along with other nations in South Asia, are members of a subcontinental civilizational family tied together by bonds of shared culture, religion, race, and language. The fathers of Pakistan and India wanted them to live in peace, not in permanent conflict. Mahatma Gandhi had the audacity to publicly call both India and Pakistan as his country. Although geographically and politically India is divided in two, at heart we shall be friends and brothers, helping and respecting one another and be one for the outside world, Gandhi famously said on January 26, 1948, just 4 days before his assassination at the hands of a Hindu extremist. Muhammad Ali Jinnah also desired good and neighborly relations, something he described as an association similar to that between the US and Canada. The ceasefire accord heralds a new era of Indo-Pak ties, but only if it can withstand the likely setbacks along the way. There are multitudes of concurring or conflicting forces, both in support and opposition of the new momentum for peace, from inside the two countries, militaries, parliaments, or administrations, along with regional and international players with some stake in the game.
If there's a peace, of course, the whole region will enjoy. The whole region will develop. The whole region will welcome. Against this, if there's any confrontation, because India and Pakistan both are the nuclear states, and they have the capabilities to destroy each other completely. That will be disaster, not only for India and Pakistan, but for the whole region. The peace is the only hope, and the hope for the Asia, for the whole region. I believe that all other countries in the Asia, they will appreciate and they will like it.
The timing of the newly achieved agreement was the source of a lot of contentious speculations in itself. It happened after months of secret talks, but suspiciously, around at the same time, India reached a somehow similar deal with China. This has caused many to question Beijing's role during the back-channel meetings. Another touchy subject purportedly linked to the ceasefire is the election of Joe Biden into the White House. Many argue that if Donald Trump had managed to stay in office, such an agreement would never have been clinched.
Given the hype in expectations and the special discourse and circumstances around the ceasefire, the agreement seems more than a strategic maneuver or a solitary move, with the impression that it is only the first step in a longer peace process. The announcement could not have emerged without top-notch diplomatic work by the two governments, and probably with some help from others. The influence of Beijing on the deal, or where China stands in this complex geopolitical equation, has remained unclear, but the timing of the agreement indicates a high correlation, as the Indo-Pak deal was publicized following another Himalayan de-escalation effort in the India-China border areas. In any conceivable scenario, the future of the new treaty will be intertwined with the dynamics of the two countries' relations with China. Another external factor with considerable weight on the ceasefire can be the new U.S. administration. India wants China contained, but does not want to do the job itself. When Donald Trump was in office, Premier Narendra Modi was certain of Washington's harsh approach towards Beijing. But with Joe Biden at the helm, India needs new tactics to control the extent of interactions between its two main rivals, Pakistan and China.
Washington is far away from this region, and we do not know how much interest they have in the peace in this region. But of course, they are close allied with India. They are bound in Quad alliance with Japan, Australia, India, and America. They, of course, are very much concerned about India, about Pakistan. We were close allies with the Western world during the Cold War, but since for last couple of decades, Washington was keeping distance from Pakistan and tilting toward India more and more.
Last year was the worst year since the 2003 ceasefire, as the two armies recorded about 5,000 bouts of skirmishes in border areas. But worst year for whom? Many of the killed or injured people are not even from the two countries' militaries. Most of them are the innocent inhabitants of the border villages stuck in a decades-long political conundrum, mainly over Kashmir. Indian and Pakistani authorities have often described the Kashmir issue as their only real problem. But can this new deal solve the issue of Kashmir forever?
Since their independence from British colonial rule in 1947, India and Pakistan have fought many wars, with regular fatal scuffles across the tumultuous borders. Almost all the efforts to bring peace and normalcy have crumbled with no breakthrough, mostly due to their irreconcilable positions on Kashmir. The Indian government abrogated the special constitutional status of Jammu and Kashmir in 2019, making the would-be independent Kashmir a federally controlled territory. For Islamabad, Kashmir is essential to the idea of Pakistan's creation, and any acceptance of the new status quo is bound to be seen as letting down the Kashmir cause. Unless India and Pakistan reach an understanding on the way forward in their Kashmir policies, the people of Kashmir will be the actual sufferers of the new diplomatic feat. Any future for the virtually non-existent bilateral relationship between India and Pakistan is only imaginable if they find a solution for Kashmir. A united Asia is only possible with a balanced triangle of power among China, India, and Pakistan, in addition to close cooperation with other powerhouses like Russia and Iran. This is not a reality yet, not until a solution is found for Kashmir.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
Now, to have more insight and analysis, we are joined by Mr. Ravi Nitesh. He's a social activist and the founder of Aghaz-e-Dosti. Mr. Nitesh, welcome to the show. So, there have been ceasefires throughout the history between India and Pakistan. Do you think this one would beg to differ and last?
Actually, what we see that first of all, this ceasefire pact that happened between the DGMOs of India and Pakistan is definitely a positive step. Whether it is different from the past or not is a separate question, because this is not the first ceasefire pact. Actually, ceasefire goes into the history since 1949, when the ceasefire line was drawn between India and Pakistan, and it followed in 1972 Simla agreement, when the ceasefire line converted into line of control. And even after that, when in 1999, the Kargil conflict happened between India and Pakistan, then the ceasefire violations goes up to very high level. And even after that, in 2003, there was a ceasefire agreement between the government of India and government of Pakistan. And after the 2003 ceasefire agreement, there is a drastic lowering down of ceasefire violations incidents. If you will see the numbers, you will find that in 2002, there were more than 8,000 ceasefire violations happened in 1 year. While after the agreement happened between government of India and Pakistan at the time of Vajpayee and Musharraf, so at that time, in 2004, it drastically goes to nil. And then again, from the 2003 to 2004, 5, 6, 7, 8, it goes to normal. And after 2012-13, it again started increasing. 2013, there was again a DGMO ceasefire promise that they will follow the ceasefire. 2018, again DGMOs promised each other that they will follow the ceasefire. And now it is 2021. Because this year, if we will see 2020, there were more than 5,100 ceasefire violations. And when it comes to the human cost, it is huge and huge. So what I see that this is definitely a positive step, but frankly, I don't see that it is very different from the historical ceasefire agreements that happened in the past, but always denied and violated.
All right, so you think that it's a positive step, but it won't make much difference. So moving ahead, Indian and Pakistani authorities have often described the issue of Kashmir as their only real problem. Can this new deal solve the issues in Kashmir?
No, I definitely don't think that this new deal can solve the problem. But definitely, if there are ceasefire violations, then it is means very highlighted issue on both the sides. And if the local population will be affected and the local environment will be unstable, then definitely there can be no other talks. So if ceasefire agreement has happened, even if between the DGMOs, which is only, I mean, army sites on
both the sides, its army ranks DGMOs. And when DGMO agreed that ceasefire will be observed, then definitely the government's diplomatic and political channels can become active to talk on other issues, including the Kashmir. Because Kashmir is not the only issue on both the sides. There are many other issues, including Kashmir. So it is it can help in creating a positive environment to take other CBMs or to talk on other things. Because when we see that there were many CBMs that were taken already on place between both the countries. There were buses going on from India to Pakistan, Pakistan to India. There were trade, there were postal services, but all are stopped. All are stopped. At present, there is no trade, there is no bus going on, there is no postal services. So what we think as a civil society persons, as a people who support the peace and people-to-people relations, that definitely this ceasefire pact brings a positive impact, a positive hope for everyone, and particularly for the people who are living near the borders and in the Jammu and Kashmir area towards Indian side as well as towards Pakistan side.
All right, Mr. Nitesh, before moving ahead, our team has collected a few global media coverages in this regard, and I would appreciate if you could just take a look and then we can move forward.
The Director Generals of Military Operations of India and Pakistan held discussions over the established mechanism of hotline contact. The two sides reviewed the situation along the line of control and all other sectors in a free, frank, and cordial atmosphere, in the interest of achieving mutually beneficial and sustainable peace along the borders. The two militaries agreed to address each other's core issues and concerns, which have propensity to disturb peace and lead to violence. Both sides reiterated that existing mechanisms of hotline contact and border flag meetings will be utilized to resolve any unforeseen situation or misunderstanding. The 2003 ceasefire came at a time when Pakistan, in the wake of 9/11, was under tremendous pressure from the US to clean up its act. This unwritten ceasefire was preceded by a back-channel process that had begun around 2000. It led to the Musharraf-Vajpayee joint statement, in which Pakistan declared it would not permit any terrorist group to operate in its territory or launch a terrorist attack from its territory on foreign soil. For people living alongside the lock, ceasefire have revived their lives, brought peace and given security after about 10 years of warlike situation prevailing in the border areas. The people in this belt were the main victims of any shelling. Now, the families residing in this area have started social functions and inviting friends and relatives to their houses. The habitats have again got an opportunity of secured life with honor and dignity. It is a fact that ceasefire will provide huge relief to people living in border areas alongside the lock on both sides and open the gates for further steps towards normalcy.
All right, welcome back, Mr. Nitesh. So, if peace can establish between India and Pakistan, will it help create a united Asia?
See, when it comes to united Asia, when if one will see the India and Pakistan, so first of all, they see that it lies in South Asia. And one can see that the South Asian Regional Coordination, that is SAARC. SAARC is almost failed concept, only because India and Pakistan were not agreed to go hand in hand with each other. Since 2016, there is no meeting of SAARC, since 2016. And whenever the SAARC meets, there are issues arise of India and Pakistan. There are many other countries. Nepal is there, Bhutan is there, Maldives is there, Sri Lanka is there, Bangladesh is there, Afghanistan is there in the SAARC. But all other issues come onto means went to back foot when it comes to India and Pakistan conflict. So definitely I think if India and Pakistan can go hand in hand, can compromise on each other, can settle their long unresolved disputes, and can observe the ceasefire, can carry the promise of developing a regional coordination and peace, then definitely it can not only help the India and Pakistan, but also the whole South Asia. And because the South Asia region is connected with all other regions, like Central Asia, Middle East, Southeast Asia, and all these, the Asia region has a huge potential, if they will just coordinate with each other and just cooperate with each other. You see that when it comes to IPI, Iran-Pakistan-India pipeline, so you see that this pipeline can definitely serve a big goal, a huge purpose of energy needs in Pakistan as well as in India. But it is not happening. It is not. When it comes to China, we see that China is a big country. China is a very big country. And when it comes to China, Pakistan, India, then Afghanistan, Iran, Iraq, Saudi Arabia, so Russia, so all these Asian players can definitely, if they will coordinate with each other and cooperate with each other, I must believe that the Asian continent can reach a greater height.
All right, that marks the end of this question answer session. Thank you so much, Mr. Nitesh, for being with us. Viewers, now people have voiced their opinions on social media and cyberspace, so let's just take a quick look at what they think.
Team Baharat wrote on Twitter, Thread India and Pakistan have provided a sigh of relief to their citizens, especially the ones who live right next to the barbed wires marking the line of control. The ceasefire agreement on Indo-Pak border is a positive initiative wholly welcomed by India. Samir P. Lalwani posted on his Twitter, in the last 3 years alone, 341 civilians had died in the border firing that included small arms and artillery shelling. Tara believes step one is to evolve a clear and relatively transparent, clear border management strategy between the two sides, but that means Pakistan giving up terror seems unlikely.
All right, and that was our episode covering the peace deal between India and Pakistan. Thanks.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran, for big and small. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Salaamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. You're listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. In this program, we discuss problems and questions parents have regarding the Islamic upbringing of their children. And the answers are mostly based upon the book Children in the Quran and Sunnah, compiled by Ayatollah Reis Shahri. I'm Hassanain, and we have in the studio our guest speaker, Brother Miqdad. He's an Islamic researcher in the Hawza Ilmiya Qum. Assalamu alaikum, Brother Miqdad, and welcome to the program.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullah. Thank you very much for inviting me.
My pleasure. The audience, last show we're talking about this question that my 3-year-old daughter, she suddenly had this obsession developed about makeup, nail polish and those kind of things. That she's very much into it, and although I haven't bought it for her and she gets all this at a friend's place, I wonder, is it okay to promote these things at this age? So last show we're talking about the aspects of makeup, and then we reached to the discussion about hijab. So Brother Mda, do you have any points to add to it?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. So in the last show, we started talking about the role and the key that the mother plays in the hijab of this young girl that's growing up.
Yeah.
And we said that mothers are role model for their children.
True.
And the way the mother dresses, the way the mother holds herself in social norms is going to have a tremendous impact on a girl, on her daughter. And her daughter is going to understand the norm and how we are supposed to deal in society by watching her mother.
True.
Now, before I carry on, it's important to note over here that definitely it's not the only cause, right? It's not to say that a daughter who is going to grow up in such a family will never be able to understand hijab. No, that's not what we're trying to say. Yeah. Definitely, as a child grows and understands and has her own source of information and knowledge and her own motivations and her own actions that affect her purity and affect her motivation, then she herself will be able to, inshallah, be able to uncover the reality and explore what Islam really says, understand it, and then apply it.
That's right.
So definitely the door is never closed, that's for sure. But it's not to deny the fact that, yes, mothers have a very strong impact on this. And therefore, strongly encourage all the mothers. We live in a modern day and a lifestyle that's very much against hijab.
Yeah.
I mean, this is
true,
to say the least, right?
Yeah, unfortunately.
Unfortunately, hijab is something that, we're going to go on the brackets over here, but I feel it's important since we're talking about it. It's not just that hijab is being attacked in the sense that we want to remove hijab.
Yeah.
But what's more scarier is that we want to change the definition of hijab, right? When you have fashion of hijab, for example, right? Where you have fashion show related to hijab, it's actually what it's doing is changing the understanding and the concept of hijab.
Yeah, what people believe nowadays is that hijab is just a headscarf.
Exactly, right? So, you know, when you want to do something, it's two ways to attack something. You can either attack it and remove it and destroy it, or you can attack it and change it in a way that you think it's what it is, but it's actually not.
Yeah, true.
Right? And the second one is even more dangerous. Nowadays, you ask people, they'll say, yeah, we all wear hijab. But this is not what the hijab that Islam is talking about, right? So hijab fashion, for example, where the whole purpose of hijab was to cover you and to make sure you don't draw attention. Fashion actually draws attention.
Yeah.
The whole purpose of fashion is to draw attention towards you.
True.
Right? To make yourself attractive and to attract attention. Whilst hijab is saying, I want to be in a way that I don't attract attention.
True.
So you put on cloth and you behave in a way that do not attract attention towards you as a female in society. Whilst today you realize that hijab has become a source of attraction.
Yeah.
Right? So we need to really, as Muslims, men and women, understand what Islam really says about hijab. What is the philosophy behind hijab? Why are you putting on hijab? Why is there so much emphasis on Islam about this hijab? And the fact that it's not just a piece of cloth. It's not just a headscarf or a long attire, for example. It's actually a behavior. It's an attitude. It's a social norm that is in place between a relationship that's built between two individuals of opposite gender. This is fundamental in how Islam understands society and the perfection of a woman and a man. And this is something that we need to understand as a community, as individuals, as family, and be able to pass it on to our children, both in our discussion with them, but also in our own actions as well.
Thank you so much, Brother Mudad. So let's take a short break over here, and we'll be right back after the break.
IRIB English Radio presents a priceless gift to parents. Do you have problem with your kids?
I
have two boys. One is 5-year-old and the other one is 3.5. And they constantly fight and wrestle with each other, and it often gets to a dangerous stage.
My 18-month-old daughter has learned to eat by herself, and she just refuses that I feed her. But usually, all the food basically goes everywhere except her mouth. So how can we allow this strife to happen for the purpose of freedom?
Don't worry. We're here to help.
For a child, the purpose of the food is only to feed. It's also for him to learn. It's also for him to explore and fulfill the need of curiosity, fulfill the need of freedom.
Islamic upbringing. Contact us. EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, dear audience. And before the break, we were discussing about hijab and how nowadays people have changed its meaning. So, Brother Gumdad, do you have any more points to add to it?
We want to try and keep ourselves to the question specific, so I'm not going to enter a whole discussion on hijab. Just want to mention a couple of points. One is that, so this girl that's putting on makeup, and we said we don't want to promote it, okay? But at the same time, we don't want to create sensitivity. We don't want to stop it. We want to allow the child to explore. Mm-hmm. It's nice. It obviously brings out a feminine aspect. It's also a very positive point as well. Because at the end of the day, it's very natural for a girl to want to show beauty, right? And you want girls to be girls, right? Yeah. At the end of the day, you want to create that feminine aspect in the girl, which is perfectly normal. And we definitely want to promote female beauty, but it has its place. It has its place at home. As a place between a husband and a wife. It's the outdoor aspect that we are wary of and concerned about in these children. So we don't want to stop it for sure. We don't want to create sensitivity, but at the same time, we don't want to promote it. Yeah, one of the things that we can do... Sorry.
Yeah, like... I'm sorry. Also, what about like parents teaching their daughters, like, if they want to wear makeup, so when to wear it, how to wear it, and where to wear it?
For example, that's a good point, but... maybe not at the age of 3 or 5, maybe at the age of 7, for example. Right? Yeah. So, sorry, when, for example, a child turns 7, then one of the things we can do is that if you want to wear makeup, then it's at home, for example. You can put your jewelry on at home, your dress is at home.
That's right,
When a girl turns around 6, 7, slowly start promoting wearing a scarf, for example. Right? It doesn't have to be the proper full hijab, it can be just a scarf. The fact that when you come out of the house, you just build slowly, slowly this habit of putting a scarf on.
So you hide your hair.
You hide your hair, for example. Yeah. It's kind of a training ground, basically. Just like you remember if we said, when we talked about prayers and fasting, right? We had this about fasting, that we have in a hadith that when a child is around the age of 8, 9, 10, it's still not wajib for them to fast. You allow them to fast. Yeah. You say, for example, fast from the morning. And then whenever they get hungry, then you allow them to eat.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Right?
Yeah.
At 2 o'clock, for example, 11 o'clock, they feel hungry. Yeah. Let them have a small snack, for example. So a child, for example, at 7 years old, a girl who's 7, when you come out of the house, she's got, you build this habit that when you come out of the house, put a scarf on, very simple scarf on. It can be a yellow scarf, it can be colorful printed scarf, basically. And it's even fine if when you get to the park, the girl just removes her scarf and starts playing without her scarf. That's perfectly normal. As long as slowly, so you build this habit of when you come out of the house, you wear the scarf, basically. Yeah. And then when she turns 7.5 and 8 and starts slowly sort of understanding the concept, understanding the meaning herself, you'll see a change in the behavior. A child who's played a lot, a child who's explored, who's had all the fun. When she turns around 8, slowly she becomes baligh, then you want to install the proper hijab then and really emphasize on it and make it a habit and a norm that this is how things are done. Just before we go to the break, just remember that I'm using these ages. The Islamic bulugh of the bulugh of a girl is at 9 years old.
Yeah, that's right.
But this is Islamic 9 year old, not not the
according solar to the lunar calendar.
According to lunar calendar, so this is 8 years, 8 years and a few months.
Yeah, thank you so much. Let's take a short break over here, and your audience will be right back.
Allah Subhanahu wa Taala. In the 80th surah of the Holy Quran, Surah Abbas, verse 24 says, فَلْيَنْظُرِ الْإِنسَانُ إِلَىٰ طَعَامِ. So let man observe his food.
Welcome Welcome back to your audience, and Brother Muhammad, we're talking about hijab and how moms can train their children for hijab before they reach to the age of bulugh.
Last point I'd like to mention before we end the show, and that is a lot of these things related to makeup and jewelry and dresses are picked up quite often from cartoons and animations that children watch. So I'd like to kind of remind the parents and give a warning that we need to be careful on what kind of shows our children are watching, what kind of cartoons and animation our children are watching. Yes, we allow children to put on makeup on and dresses and try, and it's fine if they want to look beautiful and enjoy these feminine things, right? But you realize that what cartoons and animations do, the likes of Frozen and the kind of princesses, not only do they change the worldview that this girl is going to have in terms of the way they dress, but also it builds an attitude in these girls as well, right? And this attitude is something we're to be very wary of. And experience has shown, and I'm sure all the parents who are listening, they will agree with this, that those children, those girls that have grown up watching Hollywood after Hollywood, animation after animation, from Frozen to Moana to all these different princesses. I know I've got the whole list. I'm sure the listeners know better than me. It builds an attitude in these girls, an attitude of being a princess, an attitude of not wanting to listen to parents, of going against the norm, basically. My parents told me to wear hijab and to be conservative. I want to go and explore the world. I want to be free. I want to make my own decision. I want to show my beauty, and it's up to you not to look. Kind of this attitude, it really comes out in these animations. And the more girls watch these, the more they build this attitude. So it's not just the cloth that you pick up from there, the lack of hijab. But it's also the behavior that you get from this. You know, princess behavior. I'm sure you know what I'm talking about. It's an attitude that is not something that's fitri. It's not doesn't come naturally in girls. It's actually adopted from these things.
Yeah, they get inspired by it.
Yeah, and it's something very, very, very dangerous, extremely dangerous. And I remember a couple of years ago, I was doing a research on these animations that have come out of Hollywood, and I was extremely surprised to see that a majority or large number of movies that are coming out are targeted to this audience. So if you look at all the different concepts that Hollywood is pushing across, right, from sexuality to violence to non-religion to pluralism, et cetera, one of the ones that comes out of it and stands out is this building attitude in girls, right? A girl attitude, that you want a princess attitude, and you can call it whatever you want. This is very, very common in these animations, and we need to be very wary of this, and parents should be very, very careful.
So you're basically talking about the attitude which goes against Islam.
These attitudes go against Islam. They promote non-hijab. They promote, they go against the perfection of a woman that Islam sees and wants for women.
Thank you so much, Brother Muhammad, and thank you so much to the audience for staying with us. And in this program, we discussed about the different aspects of makeup and different aspects of hijab. And also, at the end, we discussed that parents should be mindful of their children, what their children are watching, because these cartoons and animation, they, of course, create a great impact on the children. So once again, thank you so much, Brother Muhammad, and audience, thank you so much as well. Thank you for joining us on the program. And if you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, please contact us at our email, englishradio@irib.ir, and visit us at our website, farstoday.com. Fi amanullah.
Islam solves all of its problems. Allah leaves no stone unturned. Perfect with no flaws at all, are the laws of Allah. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz for Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Heartbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Badr 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.